from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this week a columnist wrote in the International Herald Tribune that the Calvinist style of religion that helped form the United States of America is very just fond of climactic battles between the elect, that is to say, the good people, and total evil. He was writing a column to explain why to explain European skepticism about the war on terror. Last Tuesday, same week, I was talking to a man in Belgrade. Yes, Belgrade. He said all during the 3 months back in the 90s when America and NATO were bombing Belgrade, the people who were left in town were going to the movies, watching American films. And I said, well, isn't that a little schizophrenic? And he said, no, we understand from your movies that Americans like stories with good guys and bad guys. At that moment, he said, we were the bad guys. We hated our government, but there were a lot of other strands to the story. The Croatians were committing atrocities too, and way back then they were the guys who had supported the Nazis. But at that moment, he continued, we were the bad guys, and that was all there was to it. Then he lit up a cigarette. Now, don't get me wrong, I wasn't exactly charmed by Belgrade. Their dedication to cigarette smoking anywhere, anytime, would gladden the hearts of the Philip Morris Company, or at least their lungs. But it sounded almost like the voice of Europe talking to me. Right now, we're supposed to have moral clarity. And everybody remembers how good that feels. When you're a teenager, you think something's wrong. It's dead wrong. No questions asked. Sometimes a war comes along that's really like that. The example of World War II gets trotted out all the time in defense of moral clarity. But either every war is a war of necessity, or, as you look at the Indians versus the Pakistanis, the Tutsis versus the Hutus, the Serbs versus the Croats, and on, you get the idea that most wars are wars of choice. And moral clarity can blind you to what lies behind the choices. What was interesting about the conversation in Belgrade, aside from the coughing fit that it ensued, was that it got beyond bad Bush and good Clinton or bad Clinton and good Bush. Maybe the war of necessity back in the 90s was preventing the genocide in Rwanda, and maybe the war of choice was partly to atone for guilt over sitting that one out. Or maybe, as my acquaintance in Belgrade suggested darkly behind his cloud of smoke, maybe it was about a pipeline across southern Europe to carry oil from the Caspian Sea. You know, Europe has had to deal with terrorism for 30 years, ladies and gentlemen. The Italians and the Germans dealt with the Red Brigades and the Bader-Meinhof gang not by declaring war on them, but by treating them as criminals, prosecuting them, locking them up. In fact, that's what we used to do to our terrorists. That's why you see weather underground survivors now stepping out of prison cells, blinking in the sunlight of a new century. When you do that, there are standards of proof. Sometimes those standards are abused or stretched or ignored, but there are still standards. Not in a war of necessity. In the world of moral clarity, there are no choices, so you don't really need standards of proof. An imminent threat becomes a grave and gathering threat. Big deal. Same diff. But is it really a war on terror? 2 weeks ago, I was in a place near where people act like terrorists, blowing up buildings, killing civilians, spreading fear. It's in Europe, and the people who act that way aren't Muslims. We know who they are, and even kind of where they are. They're in Northern Ireland. They're terrorists because they hate Britain, and we know the terrorists hate freedom, and the British are free people. We actually supported people who acted like terrorists not so long ago in Nicaragua, but they hated the people we hated, so they weren't terrorists. You can probably think of other examples. In the family of countries, we're a teenage nation. You're either with us or against us. That's not cowboy talk. Cowboys are loners. It's the talk of teenage gangs. You have to pledge undying loyalty to your colors before you can even raise the question of whether the guys should get their Harleys tuned or whether moral clarity demands that all the Crips be gunned down in drive-bys. In this sense, maybe our parents are the countries of Europe. Maybe Britain is our indulgent mom, hoping that if she supports us, we'll be not quite so wild and rowdy. And maybe France and Germany are our more distant and dubious dad, wondering aloud if we can be trusted with the keys to the family Hummer. And maybe that leaves us, in the meantime, driving too fast down the middle of the world. Hello, welcome to the show. You hit every one, and one of them's got to be the right one.
Well, I've got a really bad feeling, about who's. It's like trying to stand up when you've been hit by a gust of wind. I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. Again. Well, I got a really bad feeling, man. It's too hard to sort out, it's too hard to discuss. Well, I've spent so many years just hanging around. Now it's a time to go back to my hometown. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. What wouldn't give for a little bit of filthy weather? Ride in a black cab or a double-decker. Cause I got a really bad feeling, man. It's like trying to stand up and you've been hit by a gust of wind. Well, so many things I don't really understand. It's like trying to be a woman. It's like trying to be a good man. You know, London is calling. I don't understand it, but I'm on my way. I don't need a reason. Feels like holiday season, and I'm on my way back to Blighty again. I'm back to Blighty again. I'm back to Blighty again.
Very nice to go traveling to Paris, London, and Rome. It's oh so nice to go traveling, but it's so much nicer, yes, it's so much nicer to come home. It's very nice to just wander the camel route to Iraq. It's oh so nice to just wander, but it's so much nicer, yes, it's oh so nice to wander back. The mamsells and fräulein and the senoritas are sweet, but they can't compete, 'cause they just don't have what the models have on Madison Ave. Very nice to be footloose with just a toothbrush and comb. It's oh so nice to be footloose, but your heart starts singing when you're homeward winging across the phone. And you know your fate is where the Empire State is. All you contemplate is the view from Miss Liberty's dome. it's oh so nice to come home. Find the Machen and the gay muchachas are rare, but they can't compare with that sexy line that parades each day at Sunset and Vine. It's quite the life to play gypsy and roam as gypsies will roam. It's quite the life to play gypsy, but your heart starts singing when you're homeward winging across the foam and the Hudson River. Makes you start to quiver like the latest flivver that's simply dripping with chrome. It's very nice to go traveling, but it's oh so nice to come home. No more customs, burn the passport, no more packing and unpacking. Light the home fire, get my slippers, make a pizza.
Oh, it's lonely at the top. was lonely at the top.
Well, last week in Leicester Square, this week back at the home of the homeless, from the edge of America, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to a repatriated edition of Le Show, and still some news from outside the bubble, because it's let's see. First of all, in Sunday's Washington Post, this is reassuring, increasingly alarmed by the failure of Iraq's governing council. That's our hand-picked Iraqi temporary ruling authority, not Paul Bremer's outfit. These are the Iraqis that we say, hey, you're running the country. Go to it, babe. Babe being, well, babe in Arabic. Increasingly alarmed by the failure of the council to take decisive action, says the Washington Post, the Bush administration is developing possible alternatives to the council. Hey, me. I'll run it. I got some ideas. Free cable. To ensure that the United States can turn over political power at the same time and pace the troops are withdrawn, according to senior U.S. officials in Washington and in Baghdad. The Post doesn't say it, but I'm going to say right here, the pace is get all of us out before next September. You heard it here. The United States is deeply frustrated with its hand-picked council members. They've spent more time on their own political or economic interests than in planning for Iraq's political future. Hey, who figured? Especially selecting a committee to write a new constitution, the officials added. We're unhappy with all of them. They're not acting as a legislative or government body, and we need to get moving, says a well-placed U.S. official. They just don't make decisions when they need to, unquote. But the new Iraqi governing thing, that, ladies and gentlemen, that'll be different. Ambassador Robert Blackwell, the National Security Council official overseeing Iraq's political transition, begins a trip this weekend to meet with Iraqi politicians to drive home the point. The United States, here's, ladies and gentlemen, talk about bearing the lead. The United States is even considering a French proposal, sacre bleu, earlier rejected, doesn't say by whom, but you know, to create an interim Iraqi leadership that would do like the Afghanis, according to U.S. and French officials. France and other Security Council members had, before the last resolution was passed, proposed holding a national conference like the Afghan Loya Jirga to select a provisional government that would have the right of sovereignty. The U.S. rejected it at the time. The administration is also considering changing the order of the transition. The United States has long insisted a new constitution was essential as a first step, and elections the final phase, but now U.S. officials are exploring the possibility, again backed by other Security Council members, sacre bleu, of creating a provisional government with sovereignty to govern until a new constitution is written. How long did it take us to write our constitution? A couple months? We've set a deadline of December for this Iraqi Governing Council to set up a committee to write a constitution. We set that deadline 4 months ago. I guess writing constitutions in Arabic takes longer. If our exit is going to take longer, if it looks like it could go more than 2 years to get it all done, there's an incentive to look into a transitional phase and some other governing mechanism, says a State Department official. 2 weeks ago, Paul Bremer, our man in Iraq, met with the council and bluntly told members that, quote, you can't go on like this, says a senior official in Baghdad. Bremer noted at least half of the Iraqi governing council is out of Iraq at any given time. Wonder why that would be. Because it's so secure and safe and nice there? And at some meetings, only 4 or 5 members showed up. Who do they think they are? The U.S. Senate? Since the council appointed 25 cabinet ministers in late August, the body has done nothing of substance, according to a U.S. official in Baghdad. The United States financially and politically backed several of the council members when they were in exile, notably Ahmad Shalabi, who gave us all of our fine pre-war intelligence. It's also been disillusioned, we've been disillusioned, by the council's inability to communicate with the Iraqi public or gain greater legitimacy. The senior official in Baghdad called the council inept at outreach to its own people. As a result, the council has less credibility today than it did when it was appointed. That's the wrong way on the curve. That's just me, but, you know, if I was less popular today than the day I was appointed, I'd say that's the wrong. And speaking of why the Iraqi Governing Council members might choose to be outside Iraq at any given time, you know, about 3 weeks ago, the Commerce Secretary of the United States was over there and said how safe he felt in Baghdad. And that was at the same time that the congressional delegation visiting Iraq had to bed down for the night in Kuwait because it wasn't, I don't know, they didn't have enough pillows in Baghdad at the hotel. The pillow mints were sour. I don't know. You know. You do know. Spain this week pulled out some of its representatives. Spain, third member, our third valued ally in Europe, has pulled out most of its people temporarily from Baghdad and Basra. The Coalition of the Wilting and the International Committee of the Red Cross shut its offices in Baghdad and Basra this weekend due to serious concerns over staff safety. That, ladies and gentlemen, the news from outside the bubble. Some of that comes through. But now, you want to be scared?
Let's get scared. Let's get scared.
This is not the British press's usual Sunday scare stories. These are stories of American security on the march. Dateline Austin, Texas, five police officers assigned to protect a power plant from possible terrorism went fishing at a nearby lake instead. They were once seen in uniform cleaning the fish they just caught. Hey, you gotta clean them. I don't know what the beef is. Well, the beef is that it's fish. A lieutenant, a sergeant, and three other officers were disciplined for fishing while on duty, FWOD. And another sergeant was disciplined for not reporting the others, according to records obtained by the Austin American Statesman. It continued the behavior, the fishing, for a year without action, says Assistant Police Chief Rick Coy. Quite frankly, we're very disappointed. We believe our job is to protect the community, and that's what we expect our officers to do. Most of the officers were assigned to the Decker Creek Power Plant near Austin as part of the department's Homeland Defense Unit. Five of the officers received suspensions from 1 to 30 days. The punishment for the lieutenant was not available because he's appealing. Well, everybody looks good in uniform, but police cited a number of department violations, including continuing to fish after being ordered to stop and instructing plant security guards to allow fellow officers onto the facility to fish. Apparently there's good fishing at the plant, at the power plant. That would keep the terrorists away. They're very terrorists are notoriously afraid of fish. And officials in a national nuclear weapons laboratory in California have lost a dozen keys to the facility, according to a report released late this week by the Energy Department's Inspector General. Greg Friedman said officials at the Lawrence Livermore National Lab have lost 9 master keys and 3 magnetic key cards to the facility, and in some cases don't know why or how long they've been missing. So the lab will have to replace about 100,000 locks in 500 buildings. That will cost taxpayers about $1.7 million, although some government officials dispute those figures. According to this story, it doesn't say whether they dispute them as too low or too high. The facility, he says, does not have adequate measures in place to ensure that such incidents are reported in a timely manner or to readily identify and address any potential vulnerabilities in security. The lab is managed by the University of California. Hey, go Bears! The university has already been under fire for security lapses at Los Alamos in New Mexico, which it also manages. We regret that the events covered in the report were very unfortunate, said Lawrence spokesman David Schwogler. But once we were made aware of this, our senior management acted aggressively to correct both the key and card issues. He says the lost keys presented only minimal increased risk to classified information thanks to redundant security systems, and there's no evidence security has been breached. How would we know? He doesn't say. Ladies and gentlemen, last week there was spurious news about Fox suing Fox. Now there's less spurious news about Fox threatening criminal charges. Not against me. Executives at Fox Cable Networks Group threatened criminal charges this week against staffers who disseminated an email last Monday that listed the take-home pay of everybody in the division. It was unclear who sent the original email, but it caused a serious uproar at Fox. Yeah, they don't want people to know how much they're paying everybody. Or how little. When it landed in the inboxes of staffers at the unit, which includes FX, Fox Sports Net, and National Geographic Channel. I'll read something right. Monday night, Tony Vinciquerra, president and CEO of the Fox Networks Group, sent an email to the staff apologizing for the distraction the email caused. Well, this should be in the... Doggone it. If this is an apology, let's get right into it. Monday night, Tony Vinciquerra, president and CEO of the Fox Networks Group, sent an email to the staff apologizing for the distraction the email caused and asking that everyone delete it and not discuss it with anyone outside of the company. After word of the email leaked, Dan Fawcett, general counsel for the unit, sent a darker message to staffers, saying the company was aware that some staffers had already forwarded the email. Quote, "You will be reprimanded and possibly terminated," the note said. He also said violators would be, quote, "turned over to law enforcement officials," unquote. A Fox Cable Network Group spokesperson said, quote, "We cannot comment on criminal matters," unquote. That possible termination, that could be painful. A former Fox executive said the revelation of staff salaries was likely to cause dissension in the ranks, and particularly would lead to a parade of executives looking to renegotiate their contracts. No, executives wouldn't do that, would they? Dateline Montreal, the lawyer for a man convicted of shooting and killing a policeman, apologized this week for singing the Bob Marley hit "I Shot the Sheriff" as he was leaving the courtroom. Despite the apology, the Quebec Law Society has opened a disciplinary investigation against defense lawyer Christian Gauthier, while the Montreal Police Union is planning to make a formal complaint. "I'm sincerely sorry to know today that family members of the victim and policeman heard me," Gauthier said. "If I hurt them, if I added to their plight, I'm sincerely sorry. I didn't think about it, and if I had, I wouldn't have sang," he said. Hey, it's bilingual. Dateline Providence, the director of Rhode Island's Department of Environmental Management, resigned this week over a profane email he sent to a fishing industry representative. Jan Reitsma quit after meeting with the governor. "What happened is totally unacceptable in my mind," said the governor. Reitsma's email berated Ralph Borjean, a member of the State Marine Fisheries Council, for not finishing work on an industry proposal that regulators weigh fishermen's catches of fluke less frequently. "The failure to finish the work, quote, makes me puke," Reitsma wrote, following up with a profanity. He apologized for sending the email and for its contents. Puke rhymes with fluke. Didn't use that defense. Darby Conley, creator of the nationally syndicated comic strip Get Fuzzy, has apologized for suggesting that Pittsburgh smells bad. Pittsburgh is very proud that it now smells good. Dateline Atlanta. An Emory University professor's public use of the N-word in September and a blackface incident last week have sparked controversy at the school that 3 years ago underwent a year of reconciliation on race and diversity issues. Anthropology professor Carol Wortham used the phrase like six N's in a woodpile at a panel, according to a complaint from another professor. Tracy Roan is the other professor. She heard Worthman make the remark. She was the only African-American among the audience. Worthman has acknowledged making the remark following a panel discussion celebrating the anthropology department's 25th anniversary. In In a statement issued, Werthmann said she used the phrase to explain how my field is viewed by cultural anthropologists outside of Emory. I'm distressed that I offended unintentionally. The Church of England in Wales has apologized for any offense caused by a joke in a North Wales parish magazine. The piece published in the Mold Parish magazine under the title Irish Medical Dictionary gave alternative meanings for well-known medical terms. Reverend Ian Day, the vicar of Mold, apologized unreservedly for any offense caused to the Irish community, adding that the Welsh were often the butt of similar humor. He added that the piece was intended to be a lighthearted item. You people messing around with humor. The U.S. ambassador to Nicaragua has issued an apology for an unflattering memo released by the U.S. embassy during a visit this week by U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell. The unsigned memo described Nicaragua as a country with little hope and portrayed pro-American Nicaraguans in uncomplimentary terms. Reporters accompanying Powell on his visit found the document in a press packet. I want to extend my apology to the country and government of Nicaragua for the insulting manner in which they were described by a member of this embassy in an unauthorized document with no basis and full of errors, said U.S. Ambassador Barbara Moore. The original memo said Nicaragua crawls along as the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti, battered by storms of nature and their own making with little hope of changing. Privileged Nicaraguans see the U.S. in a generally favorable light, the memo continued. They prefer to dress in Ralph Lauren shirts, drive large Ford SUVs, watch American movies, and when going out for a meal, brag that they go out to TGI Fridays. That's why we needed the Contras, to bring TGI Fridays to Nicaragua. Nearly 6 months after jockey Jose Santos was cleared of any wrongdoing, the Miami Herald has apologized for a story that led to an investigation into whether he used an illegal electrical device during his victory aboard Funnyside in the Kentucky Derby. Santos said the newspaper had not contacted him personally. He was unaware of the apology. And finally, two international apologies. In Sierra Leone, the Liberian interim leader says Liberians are now committed to peace, and he apologized for all the wrongs his fellow countrymen committed during the war years. I want to sincerely apologize to the people of Sierra Leone for all the harm and hurt that Liberia and Liberians have brought to them. Not all of us endorse these things. These are not the values of the Liberian people. It's nowhere in our culture where these things sprung up from over the past years. I don't know. We deeply regret the hurt. We beg you to forgive us. We beg you to put away the bitterness. And let's be brothers and sisters again, at peace with one another. And let's move our country forward. Didn't say which country he meant. Finally, Brazil's government has apologized to the country's senior citizens for forcing them to show up at Social Security offices to prove they're not dead. The policy launched earlier this week applied to people aged over 90 and was intended to root out fraud, but it was hastily revised amid a hail of criticism. Pensions Minister Ricardo Berzoini went on television to apologize after the government was accused of cruelty and inhumanity. He said he wanted to apologize publicly to the nation's pensioners. They now no longer have to prove they're not dead. Ladies and gentlemen, this will not be of much interest to people on the East Coast, but here on the West Coast, we sometimes have to fly to the Pacific Northwest. We sometimes have to take Alaska Airlines. For those of you who find yourself in that unenviable position sometime, just be warned. It's not on their attractive billboards. It may not be told to you when you buy your ticket or make your reservation. But they'll sock you $25 per if your bag's too heavy for them. The reason? They're trying to reduce the number of workplace injuries. You've been warned.
There was no more. From CPR, Continental Public Radio, this is Book Bag. Book Bag. Chit and chat about the fascinating world between the table of contents and the index. I'm Ira Zipkin. We've had many embarrassments on this program. One thinks of the week that Gore Vidal recited two stanzas of his love poem to Timothy McVeigh. But this week our embarrassment is one of riches, since we have not one but two guests, each of whom has authored an important new book. Each. Robert Bloom is an old friend of the Book Bag, if indeed bags can have friends. The baseball editor of the Atlantic Monthly and author of more volumes of elegiac prose about the national pastime than seem remotely possible. His latest is called A Hitch in the Livery. And Jonathan Dreidelman is an important cog in the neoconservative machine, a thinker in residence at the Murdoch Institute, and himself the author of an imposing new book, one could almost call it an impose, called The View from the Eagle's Nest. Gentlemen, welcome to the Book Bag. And Robert Bloom, let's begin with you. A Hitch in the Delivery, I'm guessing, is not about pitchers.
No, Ira, and it's not about pregnant female baseball writers, either.
Well, it does leave us with the rather plantant question of what the book is about.
Ira, as you know, a couple of very significant baseball franchises in Southern California have been put up for sale.
The Dodgers and the Angels.
That's correct. I spent the off-season in both front offices watching the way the game of selling a major league team is played. It's a game with its own rules.
And nobody's yelling, kill the umpire.
I guess you could say that. So I wanted to write a book that captured the sweet sadness, the bittersweet hope of a baseball team where the metaphorical catcher is flashing only one sign, the for sale sign.
I'm captivated already. Did you write about the Dodgers or the Angels?
Interesting question, Ira. I decided that I wanted to spread my wings a little bit with this work, so I combined observations from both teams into the story of a fictional team I call the Los Angeles Amigos. Hmm. It's owned by a large company, the Maximus Corporation, and the company realizes, as the book begins, that the splendid frustration of owning a major league franchise is not conducive to a 35% profit margin.
Are they in the National or American League?
The Amigos? It's left up to the reader to imagine that detail. But what I've tried to do, Ira, is to capture that springtime moment when life seems possible again in all its innocence and hope, when it seems that the sale might actually be consummated.
Springtime moment, then, is a metaphor. You're not talking about the actual springtime of the year.
In this case, no.
Well, we'll hear you read from A Hitch in the Delivery in just a moment, but I want to turn to our other guest right now, since he's been spending the last 5 minutes looking at the back of my head. Jonathan Dreidelman, you come naturally to the worlds of politics and ideas, of ideas about politics as well as the politics of ideas.
I guess you could say that, Ira.
You're the son of the influential Trotskyite writer and polemicist of the 1950s and 60s, Seymour Allen Dreidelman.
Yes, and then, of course, he became a Maoist in the late 60s, so, well, you've heard of red diaper babies. I was a Mao-suited teenager, very bizarre. I wore the same jacket for all 3 years of high school and to my prom.
Blue?
Well, I wasn't invited to very many parties.
No, I meant that was the familiar blue Mao jacket that so many of us affected back then.
That's correct.
And your ideological journey since then has been, I guess it's safe to say, quick and far.
In a way, yes, of course, since I became an adamant champion of free enterprise, an advocate of limited government, and along the way, something of a fashion plate at any given moment, I own more than 100 Hugo Boss suits.
Suppose if that prom ever comes by again, you'll be ready. But in your new book, The View from the Eagle's Nest, you seem to be retracing some of those steps. First of all, the title. Mm-hmm. Are you referring to the elevated point of view from high on a ship's mast?
No. I'm referring very specifically to the view that America has of the rest of the world at this very significant moment. I call it a turning point in world history.
America being the eagle.
Yes, that's right.
and the nest being where America sits. And the retracing of your steps has something to do with that view.
Well, Ira, when I was young and rejecting Marxism, it seemed particularly absurd to hear my father's friends and colleagues referring to American imperialism. Mm-hmm. You know, it just seemed such a ludicrous concept on its face. This was a democratic republic. On the rare occasions when we subdued countries in the past, the Philippines or Cuba, we did so only in order to free them. That's not the way empires behaved. But in a post-Soviet world, we are the empire. That's not our idea, that's history's. And so, like it or not, we have to assume the mantle of empire and make it work for us.
And a reviewer said your thesis might be summed up as, when you're Rome, do as the Romans do.
Well, that's a very silly and almost childlike formulation, but it's essentially correct. At the end of the day, more properly at the end of this historical period, however long it lasts, hopefully several hundred years, people are not going to ask how nice America was. They're going to ask how well it fulfilled its imperial responsibilities. And to say we sat in the corner and rejected them is to say that we were the cop who slept in the station house while the 9/11 call went unanswered.
This is assuming they have 9/11 calls in the future.
Yes, that's right.
We hear so much about the influence the neoconservatives have on this White House. Has the president read your book?
Yes, as a matter of fact, he has, Ira. I'm proud to say I got a note from him just last week. He just finished my chapter on the lessons of Byzantium.
Well, without giving away confidences, can you tell us what he said in the note?
He said he found it very instructive, and he added in jest that he used to think Byzantium was some kind of hair tonic.
Some would wonder whether it was in jest.
I think that some would wonder that are beneath intellectual contempt.
Jonathan Jadelman, just one of your controversial notions in The View from the Eagle's Nest, you suggest a new way to make America independent of Mideast oil.
That's correct. So-called energy independent schemes are basically just a way to get the federal government into the business of making us sell our Hummers. We're dependent on Mideast oil because that's the region where we currently have large numbers of troops stabilizing the situation. That gives some very unsavory nations too much leverage over us. If we balance things out by having large numbers of troops stationed anywhere in the world where there are serious oil reserves, the Middle East will shrivel in importance as a natural process without the American people having to buy one single bicycle.
Well, all I know is the saddle hurts my seat. Robert Bloom, take us back to the Men of Winter in a reading from your book, The Hitch in the Delivery.
Okay, Ira, this is midway through the negotiations to sell the team to a New York sports executive. The sky darkened to a gloomy symphony of grays. The flag out in Amigo Stadium center field whipped around in the stiff onshore wind, a hyperactive fraternal twin to its somnolent summertime self. Peter Quinn paced in his office as if counting off feet from third to home in a long-ago playground. The phone rang, a shrill signal, a play ball of the soul, that the negotiating game was about to begin. Quinn was a TV man, not a baseball man. His idea of a big ballpark promotion was Jim Belushi night at the end of July. But in the 8 months since he took the job, he'd inhaled the smells of the game, the infield grass newly cut, the concession sushi in the bottom of the eighth, the locker room after the visiting team is gone. So he was preparing to take an outrageous position and ask for too much money for the team. He was, he realized later, about to strike out on balls.
Strike out on balls. What an ironic metaphor of futility.
Well, it's actually a metaphor of over-testosterone behavior. Balls, as...
Gotcha. You know. Always room for another entendre, but unfortunately no time for further badinage. Robert Bloom, Jonathan Dreidelman, thank you for proving that where fascinating authors are concerned, two really are as good as one. Next time, more about life between the bindings. For now. I'm Ira Zipkin, climbing out of the book bag. Funding for this program came from Borders Without Doctors, the bookstore chain that sounds like a charity. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is a pretty notable week in the news. This was the week that two other alleged rapes upstaged the Kobe Bryant case. The author of Jessica Lynch's book says she was. The doctors who treated her in Iraq said she wasn't. And then there's the whole kerfuffle about Prince Charles. But my favorite story of the week was California Governor-elect Arnold Schwarzenegger announcing he's going to hire a private investigator to look into the charges that he groped women without their permission. Weren't the Republicans, like, really ticked off that Bill Clinton allegedly hired a private investigator to look into the Paula Jones deal? Yes, they were. But, you know, when you can't remember what you did, you got to hire a guy to remind you. And finally, when officials at the Smithsonian Institution unveiled a new home for the World War II bomber, the Enola Gay, in August, they hoped to avoid the kind of controversy that had previously plagued efforts to exhibit it. This was the airplane that carried the first A-bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. Now a group of scholars, writers, activists, and others have signed a petition criticizing the exhibit for labeling the Enola Gay as, quote, the largest and most technologically advanced airplane for its time, without mentioning that it dropped the bomb in Hiroshima. You wouldn't display a slave ship solely as a model of technological advancement, said David Nassau, a cultural historian at City University of New York. The Enola Gay is exhibited at the Stephen Udvar Hazy Center, that's a man's name, with other vintage planes. Its explanatory placard is two paragraphs long, including the information that while it was originally built to be used in the European fighting theater, it found, quote, its niche on the other side of the globe, unquote. Greetings, citizens of Hiroshima. You're just witnessing our niche. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of Le Show. I'll see some of you in San Francisco later tonight, but the program returns next week at this same time on these same stations on NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, 7.415 megahertz, across the broad continental swath of North America on Sirius satellite radio, and hurtling around the globe via the internet, wherever you want it, whenever you want it, at two different locations, harryshear.com and kcrw.com. And it would be just like Anthony Pelicano being that private investigator hired by the governor-elect, if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much, all right. Look it up. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. Le Show playlists usually available at harryshearer.com. Hey, you won't hear anything from me about Joan Crock's $200 million to NPR because this show isn't on NPR. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.